Members,
let's get started. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but Representative Moran, if you want to come up and we can get started with your bill, and we'll officially call ourselves in when we get one more person showing up. And this is House File 140.
Here we go.
Here we go. Wait a second. Here we go. Now we're officially have a quorum. And that's fine. It's let's get to some housekeeping here before we get started. If you get yourself ready, first off, Representative Quam, did you read the minutes for the 26th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I did, and I would move those minutes.
The minutes for the meeting of February 26th have been moved for approval. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. And did you get a chance to also look at the 27th?
Yes, I did look at those, and I would move those minutes for approval.
Representative Quam has moved this February 27th minutes for approval. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
The ayes have it. The minutes are approved. And members, next thing here I got on my agenda is House File 353, which we heard yesterday, Representative Murphy's bill. After talking back and forth with her and talking with the other staff, we're going to move this ends up in her committee. She's going to look at the money, so it's not going to cost us, hopefully. So we're going to move House File 353 to be moved to Ways and Means, and with the recommendation that it get to capital investments. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. So now, Representative Moran, I'll move House File 140 to be before us. Possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So welcome to the committee, and good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. It is good to be here, and thank you so much for bringing this bill before the body. This is a bill that I carried before, and happy to see it here today. So what the bill does is it repeals the Minnesota 30-hour specialty license for hair braiders that was enacted in 2007. Last year, this bill was House File 3664. It passed in this Government Operations Committee and State Government Finance Committee by a voice vote, and was included in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill, and then further consolidated into the Omnibus Supplemental Budget Bill, which was vetoed. House File 140 is a technical bill. It codifies in state law the consent judgment in Lillian Anderson case that the Institute for Justice litigated successfully. And Hennepin County Judge Isabel Gomez issued a judgment that enjoined the board from enforcing any licensing requirements on braiders. Lawyers of the cosmetology board interpret the injunctions as stopping the board from enforcing licensing requirements on braiders. For that reason, the cosmetology board remains neutral on the bill. And members, I just would like to share a few. When we talk about braiding is a natural, it's just naturally what Africans do. It is passed down from generation to generation to generation. You know, I do it, my daughters do it, sometimes my sons, but my mother, my grandmother. So it is just a part of what we do. It doesn't entail altering the hair in any way. There's no chemicals involved. The only instrument that is used to braid hair is a comb. That is it. So I have here with me Megan Forbes from the Institute for Justice, who is here to answer some questions, and she may have has a statement.
And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 140. My name is Megan Forbes. I'm an attorney at the Institute for Justice. We are a national nonprofit public interest law firm, and we work to end unnecessary regulatory barriers to earning a living. We litigated the lawsuit involving Lillian Anderson and other hair braiders here in Minnesota against the Cosmetology Board. We have been active across the country in working to reform licensing laws to help braiders earn a living. We support this bill for two reasons. First, it cleans up the law and brings the state into compliance with the court judgment our law firm obtained on behalf of Lillian Anderson and other braiders. Second, we support this bill because it eliminates an unnecessary barrier to earning a living here in Minnesota. Braiding is natural and safe. Our law firm has studied the safety of braiding, and we've found that braiding is just as safe in states that regulate braiding as in states that do not. And the only difference is states that have stricter licensing requirements for braiders have fewer braiders who are working. In conclusion, braiders should be earning a living and not a license. We thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
And members, the reason this is before us is because of the fee that goes with the license that they can, that they're charging, even though they cannot regulate them, so they're eliminating the fee because there's no reason to charge a fee when they're not providing a service. Will count against our budget target. So that's why they're here, and that's why it's being held over for possible inclusion. So any questions, members? Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Moran for bringing this forward. This seems really common sense, and I think that when we can try to remove barriers to employment for folks who are looking for work and looking to be entrepreneurs in their community, and we can do so safely as we can do here, then it seems like something we should do. So just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Representative Moran.
I agree. It is just really a barrier to entrepreneurs. A small business is a job killer, and it's unnecessary. So I appreciate your comments.
We have a couple other testifiers here and members. This was heard in government ops. These other testifiers, that was a very cold day that some people had trouble getting to the Capitol. So we're allowing some testimony here on. So if Mary Reed is here, who would like to speak on this? Representative Quam, she's coming up. Do you want to ask a question of the current testifier?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering, is there a fiscal note since there was a fiscal impact? And the props.
Yes, there is in your packet. It should be in your packet.
Okay. What is the threshold for fiscal notes?
I think my understanding is $2,000 cost. That's what I believe. That's what they if they go ahead, then it has to go to Ways and Means. So, I mean, I don't know if there's a fresh threshold on fiscal notes, but if it's a $2,000 cost, and the sending wants to. But we have to get a fiscal note to find out what the cost is. But anyway, this the reason why it's here is because they're eliminating the fee because they're not being able to regulate. And Ms. Reed?
Yes, is it okay to
yep, you can come to the table. Yes, I was just he was answering his question while you were coming up.
Maybe we can
grab you can grab a chair there. Yes. And if you go to the table, pull it to the table.
Mr. Chair, while we're...
That's okay, yeah. It's not something you... We do this every day. It's not something...
Clarification.
Representative Hewitt.
Just a very quick clarification, just so I understand this right as a freshman. I'm looking at the fiscal note here, and the expenses to keep this program are, am I right, members, is it $21,000?
Ms. Reed, or Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair and members, there are two parts of this fiscal note. As the chair referenced, there's an ongoing revenue loss of $3,000 per year, and that would automatically count against our target because it's a revenue loss. Mm-hmm. The one-time cost of $21,000, you will see on page 3, there's a table outlining those one-time costs to the board primarily for working on their database. And just to clarify, because the bill doesn't have an appropriation in it, this fiscal note is just informing the committee. The committee would have the choice then whether to fund that piece of the fiscal note.
So that would be the $21,000 that we would fund if we prefer. Okay, thank you.
Good question. Ms. Reed, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mary Reed, and I am here to thank you for recognizing that hair braiders and service providers are separate and distinct from cosmetology and cosmetology service providers, number one, and I appreciate you cleaning up the law, Representative Moran. I hope to ensure, one of the things I'm here for, so I hope to ensure better tracking of the funds, and I see from our fiscal notes that it really is going to cost maybe to extract this, but it is a worthwhile proposition in my mind, because even though there's a minimal or decreasing leverage that hair braiders or those who wanted to be registered have, it is just necessary that they be separate. I would hope that you would consider setting aside any fees that had been collected prior, like from 2007 up into this fiscal note, that if there are any fees that braiders have that are available to them, that they be rolled into a committee or some entity like the Women of Color, I think it is, Women of Color Opportunity Act. I saw that there are some bills that have just been introduced, SF-1123 and HF-841, and if there are funds for hair braiders that they could access, I think, even though they have a lot of organizations and you know, small entities where they work together, there's not really a cohesive place that they could go to grow. And they may have started as a folk art, you know, braiding, what you do at home, that type of thing. But there are many who want to grow their into businesses. So it could be from folk artists to cottage business to working with the general public on a larger scale. Then they need a place that they can grow, and I think that would be a great place to start if that is something that you have any kind of control over the funding for. Also, if there were some collaborative video, like with those groups, that people who are, in the industry could learn some basic, not techniques, but things that would affect them that are very unique to them regarding different types of infection control or taxes or safety issues related to, for example, needle pokes or fumes, you know, industrial hygiene stuff. If those were things that they could grow and learn and access as public information, that would be great. I don't know how much money if there's any money at all, but I think one of the places that I saw that they could be kind of directed to and grow is with that bill. That's all. I am open to questions.
Well, thank you. Any questions for this testifier?
Is it okay,
Representative Moran?
So let's talk offline, because the Women of Color Opportunity Act is also my bill. And it brings a whole new perspective of what we can do within that bill around entrepreneurship, small business, and some of the things that you spoke about. So let's talk further.
Absolutely. I'm very excited and happy for all that you've done. Thank you. Oh,
thank you.
And Institute for Justice as well. Thank you.
Thank you. The next person I have is Denise Jarrett on the list. I see no one coming to the... And then a Gwendolyn Barber. And I see Gina Fast here, the Executive Director of Cosmetology. I think she's here just to answer any questions we might have. So members, any questions on the bill? Any questions of the testifiers? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these questions would pertain to Ms. Fast. So good morning. Ms. Fast, I'm looking at the fiscal note.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit in a quandary. I share Representative Moran's belief that this registration should have never happened. It doesn't make sense. But to unwind it, it doesn't make even more sense to me. You know, because if you take a look at page 3 of 4, and you're suggesting that we have to initiate 3 separate and distinct technology projects to disable the components that have been put in place for hair breeding registration, each of which in total is going to cost $4,700. Then you're going to ask the database provider to work on this on behalf, which is an additional $16,000. Mm-hmm. For 152 registrants. Ms. Fast, can you explain why you come up with those numbers? This should be, in my mind, a simple flick of a switch to disable the registration process. Mm-hmm. And how did we ever get to a point where it costs more to disable a program than you collect in fees per year?
Welcome to the committee. So please state your name for the tape, and then you can answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So the state of Minnesota has a contract with a database vendor that that the Board of Cosmetology uses, as well as a few other licensing boards. The state contract sets out the rates. It's a signed agreement. We have we are a part of that agreement, and when it doesn't matter in a database whether you have one licensee or 100,000 licensees, we have to capture the same amount of information on the back end, as well as the public facing side of things, as well as the financial capture side of things. So that is where the, if you look traditionally at virtually any Board of Cosmetology fiscal notes, you will see the rates. MMB requires us to put the contracted rates in there. So that is what you're seeing, is that you are seeing the rate from the vendor that is an approved state vendor. You're seeing the rates of my staff person who has to design the project, scope it out, tell the vendor everything we need to have disabled on the back end system, on the public facing system, as well as the financial systems. So while it is, I wish I could come in here and have a much lower number, this is the reality that small agencies, and frankly any agency that I'm aware of with the health boards, would have to do. When we had mobile salons, we have one licensed mobile salon. I believe the fiscal note was about $50,000 for database costs. So I wish I could come in with lower numbers, but that's the reality of disabling this license.
And could you please state your name for the
team? Oh, I'm sorry. That's Gina Fast, Board of Cosmetology Executive Director. I didn't get to my testimony, which is where it's written.
Yeah. Anyway, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Capture on the back end. I have a response to that, but it's not really kind. But you know, Ms. Fast, and this isn't intended directly at you, mm-hmm. but it is symptomatic mm-hmm. of what our agencies, we have created an untenable position for our taxpayers, because now what you're saying is that in order to relieve 150 or so hard-working entrepreneurs who have paid $20 per year for 10 years or more, now you're telling all of us that in order to relieve them of this burden, we're going to have to spend $21,000 just to stop, which would have should have never started in the first place. Can you appreciate the frustration of the folks around this table when we are trying to, as Representative Moran and I shared last evening in another committee, the heart's desire to take care of those that are most vulnerable amongst us, and then we come into this committee in the morning and we find out the waste that is going on in our agencies by virtue of creating a technological
nightmare that is fraught with bureaucracy that does not need to exist. I'm very sorry for your constituents, Representative Moran. I'm very sorry for the people that just want to go about their business in a way that compensates them, gives them a challenge every day, provides them what they need to raise their family and impact their communities in a positive way. This, Representative and Chair Nelson, is what we should be talking about on a daily basis, about how can we free up people such as the constituents of Representative Moran and others from this. This has got to stop.
Ms. Fast.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that the expectation on agencies is to have this information publicly available on a license lookup, which that's where one of the projects, when I say the back end, I don't want to dismiss the robustness of the back end. It is what our staff work off of. It is what every single licensee, everything is captured. They can go online and change their name. I understand where you're coming from. I also wanted to comment that that this should have never happened. The Board of Cosmetology did not come back after the lawsuit to create the 30-hour class. It was hair braiders themselves. So we are enjoined from coming to actually propose legislation. And I think it was in the policy side of things that there is a lot of confusion about this registration. It's not a license. The board can't go inspect. The board has no idea if there are complaints, how dirty the salons are. Many of our complaints in the cosmetology arena are generated from the board actually going out and conducting inspections, which we're at roughly doing them every 16 months. We're continuously getting closer to 12 months. But there is grave confusion about the state of this current hair braiding registration. It's not a license. It's not serviced from the board staff from a public protection side, the same as all of our licensees. So the fact that this should never be here, it's not on the Board of Cosmetology that the 30-hour registration came up. I also think that the board we get just as frustrated when things happen, whether it's legislative mandate, et cetera, where we do have to go and capture all of this electronically, and then it's undone within a year or two because we have to create licenses, and then we have to undo them. On the Senate side, we have eyelash technicians, and right now we've completely invested in creating all of the licenses, and now it wants to be undone. We'd have to undo our entire database. So the fiscal notes are meant to be the reality of what's going on and the truth. I think that's why you guys all get them, and I wish, whether it's the Department of Administration, they negotiate the contracts. The Board of Cosmetology does not. Well, I think it's Minute now. We don't negotiate these contracts, but this is our database provider as well as several others.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this one, I have to agree with Representative Albright. An application of this nature, a change like this, should be a configuration. An end user should be able to go in and just delete the records without having to have IT intercession. This is a very weak application if this is, in fact, what it requires.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a lesson to members. Be careful what people ask for, because we frequently have people coming forward wanting to be registered, licensed, and sometimes it might not be the best choice. But I'm assuming if we paid a fair amount of money for this system, and I'm wondering if the testifier can tell us, if someone moves out of state or dies, do you already have a mechanism to remove their name?
Ms. Bast.
Mr. Chair and members, we would inactivate their account, which we can do, but if you're looking for the complete removal of the hair braiding registration to the, like, for instance, for the public to go online and look at the license lookup, that is a project to undo the hair braiding registrations in the financials, to completely do what we would need to do to clean the database, this is what it costs. Yes. But because what we don't want to do is have people go on the website and start looking up hair braiders when the registration no longer exists. So we have to do, we have to design it. We have to tell the technology company what we need removed. We have to test it. And then we have to implement it. And that takes staff time. I wish I could take my staff and move them out of all of these technology components. But this is the reality of a small agency.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Well, basically, you just delete some code out of the query. Basically, on your website, you just delete that field off that page. The minutes that are involved are pretty trivial. It just seems... if you're a good fiduciary with the people's money, you look at this and say, really? And then you say, what are our options? I don't think the step, what are our options, was asked. And maybe the vendor saw you coming when they wrote it up. Almost every one of the contracts has billable, has a thing so that if you fix something or tweak something, there are billable hours, and the total hours involved in doing this, actually they would probably go between morning, you know, sunrise and sunset. So I would ask that maybe someone involved sit down and say what options. And if the vendor is not amendable, gee, maybe we can find out and have them removed from being a vendor for the state of Minnesota.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I bet you thought this was going to be a simple bill, didn't you? Mm-hmm. And it should be.
Well, Representative Green, it's we're actually relieving the hair braiders and not charging them the $40 or whatever the fee is, and we're taking that off of the backs of these people, and so they're not paying this. And this is what the fiscal says the cost is going to be, whether we include this in the budget or not, or make them the cosmetologist will eat the cost. That's yet to be determined. So, members, I think we're spending a lot of time on an issue here on a simple bill that we're basically relieving people and letting them work and have a business without charging them and regulating them.
So,
Representative Green.
So, Mr. Chair, and you're exactly right, and this might not be the conversation to have here, but I'm just going to give the newcomers here a little lesson, because I've gone through this since I started here. And what we have is, and I'm not going to pick on this agency, I'll just pick on all 100 of them. Every time they want to do anything, they will bill for that, just like you would if you took on a job. And a lot of times what you'll do, and I've asked these questions, is, are you going to hire anybody new? Well, no. Are you going to fire anybody if you don't do this? Well, no. So you got people working in the office, and they're there, they're state employees, they have a job to do. But every time you do something different, even though they're there doing their job, they're going to bill the state for more, and its agencies will fund themselves in this way. And it's something that I've really been trying hard to fix, and maybe now this is a good lesson for you, because this is very, very small compared to what we deal with here. And if we can get a handle on this and put these agencies back under the control of the legislature, because we do control their purse, instead of having them come and say, you want us to do this? Give us more money. And so it's kind of a lesson, but it's probably not for here today.
Representative Claiborne, did you? You had your name on the list, then you waved it off. But
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, you know, I appreciate Representative Green's comments. We new legislators were not here. We didn't put this into the statute. We didn't ask for it to be in the statute. I think Representative Moran's bill is an important bill, and I think the takeaway is be careful what we ask for. There are costs associated with everything we ask for, but I believe, as you stated earlier, this conversation on how we do websites, who does the websites, that's a conversation for another day. the bill before us is, will we or will we not waive these fees? And I think we're in agreement that the fees need to be waived. So I would ask that we just move the bill.
Representative Hewitt.
Real quick, and that's where I want to come back to, Chair. Representative Moran, it sounded like this procedure is very simple. My health care PAC side, nothing's flagging me here at all on this. It's done with a comb, is that correct? Is that what you said earlier?
Representative Moran. Chair, Representative Hewitt, that's it.
Yeah, and so I see no harm, no foul. We need to move forward. I'm with you, Chair. Let's go.
And members, remember that this is something that past legislatures put this in effect. And coming out of the construction industry, when you have change orders on things, when you change things, you know, on a bid project, if there's additional costs or different costs that come with that. So members, with that, I'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thanks for your time.
Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins. This is another bill that's going to be possibly held over for possible inclusion. Do you want, Representative Elkins, you want to make the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1358 be brought before the division to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division's omnibus.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And proceed with your testimony. And when, as your testifiers, as they speak, make sure you say your name for the tape.
So this bill is very simple as it's written. It just appropriates $100,000 in fiscal year 2020 and $100,000 in fiscal year 2021 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Administration to be used for grants to cities and counties to improve website accessibility. So first of all, I'll say that I understand that by the time this bill comes back to be discussed as part of the omnibus bill, we know that we need to flesh out the criteria and the procedures working with the Minnesota Council of Disabilities and the Department of Administration so that the process will be very clearly laid out for the committee. And I should also mention that my wife loves to bake, but I don't eat many baked goods. So every time she hears an excuse to bake, she goes, so this is my wife Judy's famous chocolate bun cake. So help yourself. It is absolutely delicious.
And if Representative Quam, if you want to pass this so we can pass it around the other side.
Yes, you've got all the time. So I have with me today Cody Olson from the Minnesota Council of Disabilities and Noah McCourt, who is a famous advocate on behalf of the disability community.
Famous.
And if you don't know Noah already, you probably do, but if you don't, I'm sure you will soon. Noah is everywhere. So I will also say that in my 25-year information technology career, mostly doing database work, I have never actually encountered the issue of digital accessibility. So I've been spending a lot of time with these guys trying to learn it. I've taken this on as a cause to build on my existing base of IT expertise and pledged that I'm going to work with the council and with NOAA on seeing also if we can do some work this summer to draft some improved legislation that would make it the regulations related to digital accessibility more transparent and easier for governments at all levels to implement. So, Cody, I think you want to start with a few comments here.
Absolutely. My name is Cody Olson. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Cody Olson with the Minnesota Council on Disability, and I am the Public Policy Director, and we are a state agency that's advised with tasked with advising the governor, state agencies, the state legislature, and the public on disability-related issues. Our mission is to advocate for good policies and programs in the public and private sectors that advance the rights of Minnesotans with disabilities. One of our core components is working with digital accessibility, with the digital accessibility of our online world. As buildings need ramps and sidewalks need curb cuts, so too does our digital world need to be built for all. Our council has institutional expertise and serves to advise our state government, business owners, and other stakeholders in Minnesota on this very issue. Let me be clear, the digital realm is no longer a privilege for some, it is a right for all. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act mandates that our government and its services be accessible for everybody. Much of government business is conducted digitally, ranging from snow emergency alerts, as we've all gotten, to informational videos on public health, applying for permits, and paying for taxes and fines online. Accessible government, especially our digital government, allows for people with disabilities to live independently in the community of their choice. Because of our online world, people with disabilities can conduct business anywhere at any time. We've seen a rise in folks asserting their civil rights to inclusion in the digital world through legal action. The Department of Justice has ruled against many of these government entities in this arena, and many have been institutions of higher learning. The Minnesota Council on Disability is in strong support to provide tools and resources to those government entities for the full participation of citizens or taxpayers with disabilities and to reduce the legal liability of our state. We urge you to vote in the affirmative of House File 1358. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
My name is Noah McCourt. I'm a self-advocate. Mr. Chair, I'm here to testify in favor of Senate File 1358. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 56.7 million people, nearly one in five Americans, have a disability such as vision loss, hearing loss, or mobility impairments. People with disabilities face significant challenges when websites are not accessible. For example, individuals who are blind may not be able to navigate a website using a screen reader if the website does not properly label graphics. Individuals who are deaf may not be able to understand the narration in an online video if it's not properly captioned. And also, many people with autism spectrum disorder experience executive functioning and motor skill issues. One example of this is I often will not use a mouse when using a computer. I prefer to use a tablet or my phone because it's touchscreen and easier to navigate. When government entities fail to make their websites accessible, people with disabilities are unable to get access to important government services and information. A prime example of this is before being updated, the Minnesota Management and Budget Office, the hiring page required an individual with a disability to press tab over 500 times before even getting to the application. Unfortunately, this is not an uncommon scenario. According to a recent study by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation in Washington, D.C., they found that 85% of government websites are not accessible. In Minnesota specifically, there are really two sides to this issue. Minnesota Statute 16E.04 establishes guidelines and processes for website accessibility, but those only apply to state agencies. The second piece of the pie is the issue of local government, which is obligated by Title II of the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, and in certain scenarios, provisions of the Human Rights Act, which speak to the need for effective communication with people with disabilities to have accessible websites. Minnesotans with disabilities continue to be left behind in both regards. The Internet is drastically changing the way the government serves the public. Local governments are particularly important because they offer citizens a variety of different services, including corresponding online with local officials, providing information about government services, and even going so far as to renew library books or driver's licenses. Cody mentioned legal action. I recently filed the first website accessibility suits in Minnesota against Carver County and the cities of Chanhassen and Young America over digital accessibility. Nationally, the number of lawsuits is increasing. In the first half of this year, there were over 1,000 lawsuits filed across the nation, which is a 30% uptick from last year, according to Cypher Shaw, which tracks these different types of lawsuits. Usually, you see an increase in civil suit when there's a new law. The ADA has been around for nearly 30 years, so the question becomes, why now? The first reason is that many potential plaintiffs have been waiting for the U.S. Department of Justice to issue their interpretation of the ADA in regards to websites. That's never happened. In 2015, DOJ decided to extend the deadlines again, and a wave of lawsuits hit the federal court system that year and the next. The second reason lies in the ways that the websites have been have developed as we move forward as a society. The functionality of websites back in the day was very basic. They looked like posters. The functionality was very simple, but as the internet took off, accessibility became less and less of a factor, and the focus on having accessible websites has continued to decline. By supporting localities and developing accessible design for websites, we continue to move forward towards a more inclusive, open, and transparent government whose information and services are available to all Minnesotans. I want to say thank you to Representative Elkins for championing this not-so-flashy and yet practical piece of legislation, and I want to urge the committee to support House File 1358.
Members' questions. Representative Green.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is pretty important for local counties in Greater Minnesota. We don't have a lot of revenue, and in a couple of my counties in particular, they struggle to do basic needs. But can you tell me how many grants this would be? What the average size of the grant would be? There's 87 counties out there, and hundreds of cities, and it doesn't even include towns here. So. What is your estimation?
Mr. Chair. It really depends on what needs to be fixed on the website. So, for example, there is if it's like one page. So, for example, Norwood Young America has one page that has significant problems, and it would probably be about $400 to fix. Whereas Carver County has more significant, so it would probably amount to a few thousand. So it really is dependent on the size of the project. And actually, I do appreciate your point on the smaller counties, because this is actually who I was intending this for.
Representative Green.
Yeah, that's great. So you're looking at between 400 and 2,000, you said, on average. Is there a way to I'm just kind of double-checking here, but is there a way to develop a program? I don't know much about computers, but apparently some of you guys up there do. Is there a way to develop a program that that these smaller entities could just download and use?
My Representative Elkins. We had, you want to pull the microphones?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. But recall last week that we had a presentation from the Department of Revenue, and I specifically asked them about digital accessibility and the new website that they're rolling out right now. And they, for example, mentioned that they were building their website on a platform that had digital accessibility features built in. So I think that would be part of the solution, is to be able to advise local governments on which base platforms would make that job easier to do, as an example.
Representative Green.
And then would there be a maximum grant size? I mean, would you cut it off? And then also, I'll just ask the second question now, and then I'll be done. Is it going to require a match?
Representative Elkins.
Those are details that we will have before we bring the bill back. So thank you very much for those questions, because those are exactly the things that we'll need to build in.
And Representative Green, I think, like you said, before we put this on the omnibus bill, we need to have some of those questions answered and asked, and figure out all those details. That's before we put it in the omnibus bill.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Elkins, thank you, and thank your wife. It was delicious. Probably one of the better breakfasts I've had this week. I'm not trying to be cynical, Representative Elkins, but you know where I'm going to shoot from the hip on this one. In light of what we just heard on House File 140, we've got $100,000 in each of the next 2 years. And in light of what Representative Green said in terms of the amount of money that might be necessary to update for accessibility, anywhere from 400 to 2,000, you have to build it, you have to maintain it, and so an ongoing expense. Or are you, I guess, a couple questions in inside of one. I have no qualms about making sure that everyone has accessibility. That's not the issue. But in the same light, in terms of, are we doing it efficiently, in light of some other just very recent conversations we've had about other database and networking issues. You build it, but then you have to maintain it, and then what happens if things change? The counties are responsible, and we're trying to help them out, and it is a partnership. And so I would just look for your commentary on where you see this going in the future beyond the next 2 years of appropriations to make sure that accessibility is maintained and the continuity with the databases is the same. Are we following down a similar trap as we've seen in other fiscal notes on issues when things need to change or we shut down programs to move to another one? So just maybe not so much a question, but you're certainly welcome to respond to it. But I think you get the gist of it.
Representative Elkins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I promise you that this is an issue I'm going to stick with. I think that local governments want to do the right thing. By and large, they just don't know how and need some hand-holding. And in terms of sustainability, I think that a big part of it will be developing a guidance on platforms, the basic underlying platforms, because you will want to encourage local governments to adopt basic technology platforms where the ability to build in digital accessibility is, for the most part, there out of the box. But I understand exactly what you're talking about, and I agree with you entirely.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up question for the author of the bill and or for the anyone that might. But, you know, typically we have an administration that's going to administer this grant program. So do you have any idea in terms of how much the holdback is going to be for them to administer these grants?
Representative Elkins.
That we will have that answer before we come back.
Mr. Cody.
Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, for your question. I wanted to point out that the Council on Disability develops resources for business, government entities, state agencies, other related maintainers of the digital world. We create and we maintain resources, and we provide educational training on digital accessibility. One of the pieces of digital access and any kind of accessibility that we talk about is we have to create institutional long-lasting change, and that's how you make it efficient. It's hard to start off when people don't understand where to go, but once you make the process systematic and institutional, it becomes very efficient, and it becomes ingrained in the way that we build our websites and the way that we build our documents. And so digital access isn't a box that we can check. It's a long-term behavioral change. It's a systematic change that we have to foster and encourage.
Representative Elkins. Visited, Mr. Chair. They have a full-time staff member, Chad Miller, on the staff, who I was able to visit with these guys a few weeks ago. And so there is a capacity at the Minnesota Council on Disabilities to assist with this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding is that the many of the local, the cities and county governments use vendors, and that because was this committee or maybe it was GovOps where we talked about the pooling of where they go out and they get arrangements, they negotiate the contracts so that if a local government wants to purchase something, they get it aggregated pricing, and if the state entity that does that implemented the options, because I know these major vendors are doing it for other entities, so that way the state could leverage intelligence in negotiating those state procurement options. And I was wondering if that's something that anyone at the table has some familiarity with.
I think you're talking about the admin where they do a state contract for large purchases, vehicles, stuff like that, and then they get a state price. Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, and there are also local government IT consortiums that basically come together and stand up platforms that are shared, and that would be a really good place for us to start, actually.
And I, from my reading of this and from just understanding of some things in the past, sometimes it's getting the idea into people's heads that when you do design new programs or new platforms or new websites that you need to take these things into consideration. Sometimes people forget about that and they stand something that has causes problems.
Mr. Chair, that I would like to work on with these guys over the summer is developing some policy guidance in those areas that might make its way into legislation next year.
I think that
Mr. McCord.
Mr. Chair, I also just wanted to say that this is something that we do intend to stick with, and that there are some. I think that part of the issue here is that simply, again, the guidance. And so, if we as a state can come up with some really clear guidance, I think the path forward becomes a lot clearer. And like I said, we're happy to work with Representative Elkins over the summer to do that.
Representative Quam,
thank you, and I appreciate the author and. You know, any other authors that might be listening, this is how you can leverage the state to assist instead of, be a helping hand instead of being a, overlord directing. Thank you.
Any other question? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because, some of the things that Representative Albright said, this isn't really a question. It's just something for you to think about as you move forward. The amount that you're looking at is $100,000 for 2 years each. And so you got $200,000. You're looking at, you averaged out about 167 grants, and ain't going to go very far. And the other thing is, we just talked about agencies. You're going to have to put in here, because every one of those agencies is going to charge you for administering these grants. And so that's going to take a chunk of your change, too. So you might just be... if you're not careful, you could just be funding another agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Any further questions? If not, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Can I just thank the committee? These are great questions. Appreciate it.
Representative Lucero. And I'll move the bill to be so it's brought before us. And I understand there's an amendment. Representative Lucero, is the amendment your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do have a DE amendment. I think it's a DE. Regardless of the type, I do have an amendment.
The A19-0057 yes. Is what I got here.
Yes.
This is a delete everything amendment, yes. So I'll move the A19-0057 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment's been put on. Representative Lucero, if you want to explain your bill. And again, this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. So, a little bit of background on this. Years ago, the legislature, or in pertaining to the Office of State Auditor, the legislature changed the law to allow what previously was the case, that the state auditor had a monopoly over the auditing of units of government, counties, and others. And the law was changed to allow the state auditor to give discretion to those units of government to use outside CPA firms, but it had to be with the approval of the Office of State Auditor. Then in 2015, this legislature changed the law again to allow the same to occur, but no longer require the approval of the Office of State Auditor to use an outside CPA firm. And at that point, I believe it was 44 counties had been granted the authorization to use outside CPA firms. And that was, in 2015. Then in response to that law change, the then previous state auditor, not the current state auditor, the previous state auditor decided to file a lawsuit against three counties, Wright County, Becker County, and Ramsey County, to prevent them from using outside CPA firms without permission. At the time, the question was asked, why were those three counties selected when there were multiple dozens of counties that were engaging in this practice, authorized, lawful practice that this legislature passed and the governor signed into law, and it was unknown, completely unknown as to why those counties were selected. But nevertheless, the counties were successful in their defense in district court. The then state auditor appealed and lost in the appellate court. And so the auditor again appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court and lost a third time with a unanimous ruling by the Minnesota Supreme Court that it was lawful to be able to use outside CPA firms without pre-authorization. So the lawsuit is concluded and everything is settled, with the exception of the counties obviously incurred expense to defend themselves against the auditor. And so you have a fiscal note in front of you that references the shared costs between Wright County and Becker County, totaling $140,606.83. The fiscal note, if you read the notes at the time that was produced, the a dollar amount for Ramsey County had not been determined. There's a representative from Ramsey County here, and I was given the number $34,652.55. The reason that dollar amount is so much cheaper is they used in-house counsel to defend themselves, whereas Wright and Becker County jointly hired an outside firm to defend themselves. So the total cost then for reimbursement of the three counties is $175,259.38. And so with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do have two testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape. And
you're elected.
Well, in that case, we'll let her go last. Anyway, Madam Auditor.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee. Yes, my name is Julie Blaha, and I am your state auditor. We at the OSA support this bill in this current form. And no matter what you thought about the lawsuit, I think we can agree that the dispute was really between the OSA and the legislature. And as a result, we think that that makes sense to keep the costs in that realm as well. And so this ensures that happens. And even more than that, though, it does help us turn the page on this and move forward. You know, some of the work that we're doing at the OSA right now includes building relationships, mending some fences. And I'll tell you, this does go a long way to assist in that effort. I do want to thank the authors of the bill for putting it into a form that, again, helps us all go forward. And, again, I urge your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Preiser. I'm an assistant Wright County attorney. And Wright and Becker County are fully in support of this bill as presented and as amended. This litigation, I could admit, when it started, brought us a lot of animosity. We were wondering, as Representative Lucero indicated, why we were selected out of the 87 counties. And there was even discussion as to whether or not we should just let it go default and not do anything with it. But we felt it was our obligation as the two selected counties to really bring forth the legislature's argument and defend the statute all the way through. We did hire Scott Anderson with the Rep. Anderson Squires Law Firm, who I think came back with a very reasonable end result here of $140,606.83. So we do appreciate you hearing this bill, and we do believe that this is an expense that should be borne by everyone in the state of Minnesota, not just those constituents living in these three counties.
Representative, questions I have. Representative Quam is first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and some clarification. There were many counties, a good portion of counties, and some cities, municipalities, that had the option and choice before the legislation was duly passed and signed and became a Minnesota statute. And the protection of the constitutionality of laws that we pass, the governor signs, should not fall on local government. And it's more of a statement as opposed to a question.
Okay, thank you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero you mentioned the Ramsey County reimbursement amount. There was a letter in our packets from Wright County and from Becker Counties, but not one from Ramsey. Has Ramsey County requested this reimbursement?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To my knowledge, they had not requested it, but I included them in here because I believed it only be fair that all three counties be reimbursed. And so while they had not requested it, that's why I included them. But again, I just want to reiterate the dollar amount was given to you. But if Ramsey County doesn't want it, I guess that would lower the fiscal note.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you approach any Ramsey County representatives or senators to support the bill?
Representative Lucero.
This year I did not because I wanted to get it in the hopper as soon as I could. But in past years, I had conversations. This is the third time, maybe the second time, I've introduced this bill.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In any of those past times, did anybody from Ramsey County, any state legislators support this bill?
Representative Lucero.
I do not recall at this time. I'd have to look at that. But I can tell you definitively nobody opposed from Ramsey County to my recollection.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the attorney's fees that are with the private firm, has there been any independent assessment of the reasonableness of those fees?
Representative Lucero.
Not to my knowledge.
So long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that something you'd support? That's typically a procedure that's done. If a court is going to be providing attorney's fees, they would assess the reasonableness. And in this case, it seems like having an independent evaluation before the legislature would pay for those fees would be appropriate. Does that seem appropriate to you?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To be honest, I don't know who would pay for that assessment. I don't want to incur any more tax dollars. We're attempting to close the door, turn the page, move on. And based on my knowledge of what attorneys charge, anywhere between $250 to $500 per hour, and these costs seem reasonable to me. But again, that's my non-lawyer opinion. But I would defer to, yeah.
And Mr. Representative Long, my understanding is the court ruled in the favor of the counties but did not assess fees, which is typically my understanding happens in court cases like this. But Mr. Kaiser.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is I believe Mr. Anderson, as the partner at the law firm, charged I think $225 an hour. So it was very reasonable at the end of the day. Mr. Anderson does a lot of municipal work, and he specifically, because of that, lowers his fee. I believe the prior state auditor, you can follow up with this, but I believe the state auditor's outside litigation fees were in excess of $400,000, I think.
Madam Auditor.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Members of the committee, I believe our costs were closer to about $250,000 over 3 years. That sounds correct. Thank you.
Representative Long.
Still less.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the counties petition the court for attorney's fees?
Mr. Kreiser.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, we did not. We came forward to, we filed an application with the Joint House Senate Committee on claims is how we ended up trying to get reimbursement. Typically, in these types of situations, there are no attorney's fees. That would be awarded by a court in these types of situations.
Representative Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there is no prohibition, from my understanding, of a court issuing attorney's fees in a situation like this. So was it considered to petition the court for attorney's fees?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, we did not even consider it.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you can wrap up, I got a list of questions.
Absolutely. It seems to me that there are many instances when the state's going to be involved in litigation that involves other units of government. And there is a process right now whereby people can petition the court for attorney's fees. It doesn't feel like we should be setting a precedent where the legislature is paying for every case we lose. That seems to me to be appropriate to take place in the court setting. I appreciate your
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, these counties were defending themselves against a lawsuit that came as a result of laws that were passed here. The lawsuit itself, and I thank the auditor for acknowledging that she's in favor of this. And just to be clear, counties are not like a business. They don't have funds set aside to fight in their budget to fight lawsuits. And this was a ridiculous lawsuit in the first place. So thank you for bringing this forward. And, you know, our counties, I can't speak for Wright or Ramsey, but I can tell you that Becker County doesn't have a whole lot of money out there. And they were very happy to win, but to go back after these costs would have cost them more, and it just wouldn't have been feasible for them to go to the courts and fight this. So this is a good bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. I hope we can get it included in the omnibus bill.
In your question there, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. This might be for Mr. Kreiser, is it? So I was on a city council for a few years, and we had, at least in some of our litigation, we were insured through the League of Minnesota Cities Insurance Trust. I'm just wondering, are these litigation costs covered by insurance at all?
Mr. Kreiser.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did submit this to the Minnesota County's Intergovernmental Trust, and they denied the claim.
Okay.
Because there was no dollar amount attached to it. It was simply fighting over the constitutionality of the statute. Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on some of Representative Long's questions as far as attorney's fees. While I was sitting here, I don't know if we could actually even attach attorney's fees because this was brought by the state auditor. There's a constitutionality of whether or not we could even seek those kind of claims from a state auditor asserting a state position as part of the state. So giving some of that immunity that could have been there, we probably could have lost on that aspect of it because she was bringing something on behalf of the state in her state capacity. So there could have been immunity grounds that we could have lost on that end for attorney's fees as well.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I would also be interested in knowing if Becker County and Ramsey County, if they're interested in this also, submitted insurance claims and what the result of that was. If you could look into that moving forward, that would be great.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. And just to correct my esteemed colleague, we didn't lose. We won. The law was considered to be and determined to be constitutional, and the difference in the estimate of the fees of 400 and some thousand to the 200 and some thousand is because I believe the Supreme Court portion of their appealing was on contingency. And I have some familiarity because I chaired the Claims Committee, the Joint House-Senate Claims Committee, yeah. And we heard, you know, this came before us, the chair sat down and looked at it. We determined at that point, since it was coming to the Supreme Court, that it wasn't ripe for us to determine. If it had been ripe, having discussed it with members of the committee was very positive towards making whole the counties that had to do the state's business of protecting and defending the constitutionality of our laws. Now, if we aren't going to do it, and the legislature, which again was part of the consideration, is we felt it was better with the legislature instead of having the precedent set in the Claims Committee that it was, you know, we would set a precedent if we did that. We decided to allow the case to finish, legislature to appropriately address it. The legislature does not appropriately address it. I am almost positive that for the next 2 years will be this senator that will chair that committee, and I'm almost positive that committee will accept hearing this claim, and I would rather not risk setting a precedent. I would rather have the legislature step up and pay for the defense of what we debated, passed, and was signed into law. So I support this bill.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, if the Attorney General had determined it was that office's responsibility to defend state statute, would there have been any costs borne by the three counties in your bill?
Representative Lucero.
Say that again. If the Attorney General, just to make sure I understand the question, if the Attorney General had decided, if you could just repeat the question.
Thank you. Right. If the Attorney General, in their capacity, had determined that state statute was their purview to defend, would there have been any costs borne by the three counties that were sued by then State Auditor Rebecca Otto?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. The answer would be no.
Thank you.
And since I have the microphone, to answer a previous question from Representative Long, former Representative Randy Jessup, who was a representative from Ramsey County, was a co-author on the previous version of the bill.
Representative Albright. Any further questions? If not, thank you for the bill, and we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
And members, there were two testifiers that came in late for the first bill, the bill by Representative Moran, and I'm going to allow them to come down and give a brief testimony. They gave me a note here that they just came in from out of state, and they just flew in and they just got here, and that's why they were late. So welcome to the committee, ma'am, and please state your name for the tape, and if you'll speak into one of the microphones.
Hi, thank you.
And say your name for the tape.
My name is Denise Jarrett.
Speak into one of the microphones. We can hear you.
My name is Denise Jarrett, and I'm with the Eco Hybriders Association, and I would like to thank you all for letting me testify, even though I'm in here late. Okay, what I want to talk to you all about, I've written a small speech on the safety of hybriding, natural hybriding. They're saying that it's ancestral hybriding, which it could possibly be that. But my concerns with hybriding is that simple herd devices is one of the definitions ruled in Judge Isabel Gomez's order, agreed by both parties that hybriding and hybriding services were unregulated services by. But the hybriders, the individuals, and the entities, we all agreed and authorized, reviewed, and approved the adoption of the bill. Okay? And the problem is now, after the approval process, the Board of Cosmetology adopted the bill, and they only do administrative services for us, which is take the $20 fee for the application. They do not have no control over hybriders. That was written in Judge Isabella Gomez's ruling. Okay. Also in the ruling for the simple hair devices, she ruled that they could have a needle. The needle that they're using is called a suture needle. And the suture needle is this needle here. This needle is what they're using to install the weaves that you see everyone wearing. Even Rena Moran, I was hoping that she would be here, the hairstyle that everyone wore, they're using this suture needle that's governed by the CDC, the Center of Disease and Control, and using this cross-pricking themselves and cross-pricking the client when they're doing these hairstyles. And this is creating an issue of hepatitis C, herpes, and HPV and HIV, because HPV leads to cervical cancer in women. You don't know other industry that does this occupational licensing with a needle, okay, and it's just using it up on black women. And black women are the ones that are using this needle, and we have seen in Minnesota 11% rise in HIV in only black women, and they don't know where they got it from. So in the order from Judge Isabella Gomez, what she stated was that she wanted the simple hair devices, which was the needle, that's the part that's governed by the Board of Cosmetology. That's how the Board of Cosmetology is able to come in here and ask for an advanced esthetician and get more money, because they got that in the ruling. What we got was just hair braider registrations. And yes, it's mandatory if you want to receive your income tax payment back, it's mandatory that you do have this hair braider's registration, okay? So all I'm asking for is that you all expeditiously and immediately amend this bill and uniform it with the other for reciprocal practices with the other 24 states that do regulate this needle, because I just fear I don't have, I'm a volunteer lobbyist, okay, for these, for this. There's no money allocated towards this or anything, but the infection control need is evident. I'm a licensed cosmetologist. I do understand that the Board of Cosmetology is over licensing. I'm a licensed cosmetologist, manager, instructor, school manager, and I was never able to get a job. However, when this came along for black women and I seen this, I then got on the list to be the heartbreaker provider. I also took it a step further. I tried to transfer the bill out of the Board of Cosmetology. I've created us as a multi-member agency to try to move forward through legislation, but you all are the only ones that hold the key to the power to this. The governor, she stated, the governor don't have no control. The Office of Administrative Hearings doesn't have control. The reviser, no one. But legislation, and I'm asking you all, because this is a procedural law, because of the needle, to govern this needle. Don't loose this needle on these people like this. Please don't. Okay? And that's all I have to say. I just came here passionately because, like I said, this is a letter from the Department of Revenue with y'all new seal on it. By March 7th, she got to have this heartbreaker registration in order to get her work and family credit. So I'm just coming here and, you know, speaking on behalf of everyone, and six of the heartbreakers, providers, we all got together. It's not just me. We all got together to form the association and make our own governance task force, because y'all gave the Board of Cosmetology a task force for the needle, but we didn't have anything. And we just on the grounds, HIV people, AIDS people know not to use the needle. You know, diabetics don't reuse needles. But these people are reusing needles, and they're not cleaning them. It's nothing written in the law besides what I make them do in order to be a part of my association. So I'm just asking y'all, since y'all the one in control. That's it. I don't want to hold y'all up. Thank y'all. If y'all have any more questions, let me know.
Thank you. Representative Green, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming and testifying. I didn't realize that. Obviously, I probably wouldn't. But have you talked to Representative Moran on this as to see if she would amend her bill?
I've emailed everybody about 100 times. I haven't really talked to very many people, but I will ask her to amend her bill. I did see her when I was in the wrong room. I was here, but I was over in the wrong room, okay? So I did see her after she left and came over there. I didn't speak with her. I thought this is where I was to be. But I will go around and ask her. I planned it on spending today and whatever time y'all have left tomorrow to lobby this bill, because I think that they are having it as a mascot and disguising it as if it's just ancestral braiding, which it's not. And then those are Liberians. We're Americans, okay? So we don't have the ancestral piece, bottom line. You know, we learn how to braid from each other, and it's not the braiding, it's the sew-in customized wigs. As well as, not only that, it's the bloodborne pathogens for reduced occupational licensing, which is a statute, and it's also the hair and scalp prosthesis, which is a statute. So I'm asking for you all to, like I said, amend the bill and uniform it with the other states. And then I got to go to the reviser so that they can make the language the same. Because it should say hair and scalp prosthesis. It shouldn't say a wig. But they had to write the statute. So.
Well, thank you. And can you please restate your name for the tape?
My name is Denise L. Jarrett.
Thank you. And Ms. Jarrett, so you know, the bill that we heard, and it was laid over for possible inclusion, is what was the action we took. The bill that we had was to reduce or eliminate the fee that we're charging hair braiders, because the courts ruled that the cosmetology board could not regulate them, and so we're removing the fee because we can't regulate them. We shouldn't be charging them for regulation. So that's what this bill did.
No, the court order ruled that hair braiding was unregulated and her braiding services was unregulated. The court order ruled that simple hair devices be wrote in the book in the state law, and it also ruled that the hair braiders be wrote in there. Those are two. The definition came with four things, and the simple hair devices was given to the Board of Cosmetology. The people are correct when they say the Board of Cosmetology is regulating that. So at any time they could change, even though we get this definition, they can change the simple implements that we use, the simple hair devices, because they rule that. So they kind of got it instituted justice. Now, that's who I've been in contact with over and over again. They kind of got it confused because they talked to me about it. But, no, it's the simple hair devices and the hair braiders. The hair braiders was governed by the entities and the individuals that came along. That's in her. These are words that's in her actual ruling, the court order.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And Ms. Jarrett, like I said, the bill, just because the courts said that cosmetology couldn't regulate them, we're removing the fee and we're removing the registration, so that and what you're trying to talk about might require additional legislation to create something, and that would be something someone would have to bring forward. But that this bill that we're talking about just removes the fee that the cosmetology board is registering and removes the registration, so that there is no registration going forward.
Yes, but what I'm saying is I believe that they need to be registered because they have a short Minnesota Bloodborne Pathogens occupational license.
I understand that
the short. So I'm asking you to amend it or to not say appeal, not support it, and let it stay like it is until another bill comes along. But right now, I don't believe and I don't think that legislation should do this. Well, so thank you.
And Representative Quam, quickly.
Yes, and to the testifier, if Representative Moran isn't interested in the language to try to ensure safety for the communities that you were discussing, you can tell the reviser that Representative Quam will help with that, and it probably would be an amendment as opposed to a standalone bill because of the timing. But I think it is crucial that, especially when we're changing something in that related area, that we do add this additional safety for the members of, you know, citizens of the state.
Yes, and that's the exact language that...
So if you want to work with him and work with the reviser to get language, we can work forward from there. So
I will. Thank you so much.
And thank you for coming. And thank you for...
Mr. Michael Nelson. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. And with that, members, again, reminder, we have no meeting on Tuesday morning, so you can sleep in an extra hour. And with that, members, we are